Hi, I'm Jesse Hirsch. Welcome to the Future Herd. Today we get to talk about a topic close to my heart. Artificial intelligence and agriculture. And in particular, programmatic breeding, otherwise known as computational breeding. That's where my new friend Mohsen, one of the pioneers in the field, not only helps us understand the way that AI can empower farmers, researchers, and policy planners, but also the courage, the learning, the curiosity required to be a leader, not just in agriculture, but in technology as well. In today's subject, we're going to get into the weeds in terms of things like Bean GPT, a custom AI for plant breeding, in particular dry beans. But we're also going to talk about some of the challenges, some of the opportunities, some of the developments when it comes to mashing together some of these powerful tools from data science and machine learning with the wisdom and intuition that we find in agriculture and agri-food. I've been waiting a long time to talk about AI in the concept of the Future Herd. And in that regard, Mohsen does not disappoint at all. I did my best to try to limit he and my potential to nerd out on these very interesting subjects. And I think we perhaps accomplished it while maybe giving you some keywords that you might search to learn more. But this is really just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to exploring how this technology is shaping the future of our sector. And we will definitely have future episodes that get into it. So think of this as both a kind of introduction and overview, as well as a specific case example when it comes to breeding beans. All right, let's listen in. Mohsen, welcome to the Future Herd.
Thank you so much for having me, Jess.
Now, I got to say, you're our first guest in this podcast who I can finally talk to AI about. So I'm particularly excited about that today. But the first question that I throw out to every guest as a kind of abstract, what's on your mind? What does the future mean to you?
Oh, that's a great question. Basically, AI and future, huh? You know, to me, the future depends on which part of life we are talking about. So I can explain future in different aspects of my life. So let's say in my professional work, the future means planning, improving, and trying to stay one step ahead. No, not at least, you know, or at least not two step behind. You know, this is something that I can just articulate that. But future in my professional life is about learning from past and gain much experience and prepare ourselves for the future. So if I can do this today, I can make my future better and perfect, right? So I like to run, and something people like sometimes tell me about the future, and they are sometimes getting scared of these fast-paced changing that happening these days. But you know what? I love these kind of fast-paced changes, and I wanted to embrace it. So this is the meaning of the future in my actually professional life. But you know, in a broader sense, like politics or society, if you ask me about it, you know, I feel that future looks a bit like the past because history has funny, like, you know, has a funny habit of repeating itself. So, or even in my personal life, if you ask me about what does it mean, what future means in my personal life, it means opportunity, because finally I can lay down and let the future, like the robots and everything, do my chores and every other things, you know. But yeah, so that's a different meaning, you know, that I have for the future. Yeah.
Right on. Fantastic. And I think you, in that answer, kind of gave us hints as to why AI and robotics is an area of interest. But let me ask the inverse. Why agriculture? Why plants? What was it about that side of science that not only did you say, hey, let's see how AI and this kind of connect, But these days, AI people like yourself, people who have that curiosity, are in high demand. You could have picked any sector. You could have picked anywhere to focus. Why plants? Why agriculture? Why beans?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, Justin. The point is, the time that I decided to work in agriculture was only because of one reason. And the reason was I grew up in a farm and I used to go to the farm with my dad. And I remember, you know, all the time my dad, you know, we're so happy at the farm, and he tried to just make me happy on the farm and just ask me that, hey, Mohsen, do this, do that, help me with that. And to be honest, on that time, I hated to do that because I was just thinking, okay, why should I do this, right? My passion was like, you know, novel, reading novel books, playing music, those kind of things. Was not actually into the agriculture. But gradually, I realized that everything that we are doing are rooted in agriculture. The food, even our future, depends on the agriculture. So if I wanted to survive and read novel book, if I wanted to play music, I need to have something to eat. And this is coming from the agriculture. How can I like make sure that there is enough food in the future? You know what? That was the simple question that I've tried to answer on that time. So I started to do undergrad on horticultural sciences. And in the horticulture, we are working with a very small scale rather than like working on the large scale field area. So on the small scale, I was working on watermelons and cucurbits, like, you know, cucumbers, watermelons. And I've started to just enjoy actually going to the farm because on that time I had these kind of like, you know, things to answer in my mind. And I had this kind of goal. So I went to the field and I dig, you know, made my hand dirty in the field. And I just realized, okay, how cool it is to work on the agriculture. And then later on, I started thinking, okay, what can I do to speed up this productivity? What can I do to ensure the food security in the future? As a graduate student, what can I do? How can I play an important role in this area? And I was just thinking, and I found that, okay, maybe we all gathering all the data. We all collecting everything. But how about get the best juice out of whatever we are producing in terms of the data? And then that was something that I started to dig more into the statistics, and then gradually machine learning. And then when I get into the PhD and I was started to work on a larger scale field on soybean, which is the agronomic, like, you know, crop, I've realized, okay, now it's time to apply those things that I was just imagined in my, like, you know, and now I can make it applied into the actual agriculture setting. And that was the time that I started to apply these kind of machine learnings and like AI and more sophisticated statistical algorithms.
Now, before we kind of get into your particular research, tell me about, for lack of a better phrase, that the ecosystem of researchers that were alongside you as you did that. Because on the one hand, you are breaking new ground, right? Digitally and physically. And I'm curious, you know, who you were looking for in terms of inspiration, right? Because you're kind of, on the one hand, inventing it as you go along. But on the other hand, it is an exciting industry. It is an exciting research ecosystem. So where were you drawing inspiration from? Because part of your answer was your dad, right? And like getting you back on the farm and thinking. But intellectually, scientifically, where were you getting clues from? Where were you getting inspiration from?
Yeah, you know, before I answer this question, you know what? The time that I started to work on machine learning, it was not as easy to say, hey, I'm computational plant breeders. Because I remember the first time that I gave the presentation, people were just telling me, okay, Mohsen, you are living on your dream. It's not going to happen. Like, you know, you are just flying drone, take some pictures using neural networks, AI. What are you doing? You know, just do some real work, you know, do be like a actual plant breeders. And I remember when I even graduated, people called me, okay, Mohsen is the computational biologist, is not actual breeder. Because they had this kind of mindset. And you know what? They were right, you know, on that time, you know, no one was predicted what happened in the future. And you know what? Sometimes What I'm trying to do, I'm just trying to. I love to read novels. I love to read, about people's work. I love to read, and I read so many books, so many journals. And one of the people who inspired me a lot is Dr. Rex Bernardo. So he is a plant breeder, and I love reading his journal, his papers. I love to attend his seminar. And he's one of the people I usually follow as a plant breeder. And that was just, I had a chance to talk to Rex Bernardo a couple of years ago, and I asked him that he, if you if he's available to meet me in person, and he did. So, sorry, meet in virtual, and he did. And we talk about so many different subjects, and I found that, okay, we are very close. Sometimes we are trying to adopt new technologies, but sometimes we are going one step back and thinking, okay, is it really a good technology or not? If it's good, continue. And then how about adding this? How about adding that, right? To make it something better, right? So that was something that inspired me to work in this area. Another one is I love sometimes, to not sometimes, but most of the times I'm trying to challenging myself. And when I'm seeing that, people are just asking me, "Hey, Mohsen, why are you doing this?" And I have this kind of things in my mind that, okay, I'm doing right. I wanted to work and make it applied and finally let people know that, hey, this is something that I told you it works and now it's working, right? So that was we call it self-inspiration. So I just had these kind of things in my mind to just follow whatever people call it as a dream. I wanted to make my dream true, comes true. So yeah.
On. And the concept of the computational breeder is revolutionary in of itself. And I empathize with the idea that when you're too far ahead of the curve, you appear as a fool. And it's not until after the fact that people respect your wisdom. So we're now at that point, thankfully. But I imagine it was a bit of a difficult path for you to get there. But the paradox is, to your point, we seem to be at a moment where people are starting to accept that our entire world is programmable, that there are elements to our world that we can engage with on the level of code and of programming. So take a moment to unpack what programmable breeding is, because I suspect all of the listeners right now, unless they've already Googled you while they've started the show, have never heard that phrase before and are still wrapping their head around what that might be.
No, that's a great question. Just so the point is, I can just make an example of what I'm doing here at the University of Guelph. So I'm working on two different areas: dry-bean breeding and computational biology. These two subjects are very far from each other at the beginning, but at the end they are super close. So in the traditional breeding, what we are doing is we are going to the field and relying on our breeder's eye, seeing if the plant is good, they has a good uprightness, it's looks healthy. We are pick it up and then grow it next year and a year and a year, and we try to just gather more data, more information. But those are usually done manually, and we are significant rely on our guts, on our feeling, right? Which is perfect, which is good. I love it. But at some point, we need to add more information. We need to see plant from different perspectives. Like, how about flying drones, take some picture from above and see if we are able to find something that we couldn't see by the naked eye, right? Or how about, dig into the genetics of the plants? Or how about working on the pure science part? Of course, we are able to do that. It's perfect. But what's next? So the next is, we are having tons of data, tons of information, and it's really hard to digest. So what would be next? Next is to select the best and appropriate algorithms, right? So we try to use AI, different types of AI, and all those kind of things to digest all the data that we are collecting. But what next? We get to the result. Okay, that's perfect. But again, what next? Next is, we can use this result as to initiate new population and work on the same pipeline and initiate a new population. So If you are seeing this is something that is started to do, like, you know, as a program, running as a program, and in each steps is the mixture of tradition with the innovation, with the coding, and those kind of things, right? All are linked, chained together. And this is the future, I think, you know, to my knowledge, this is the future of the breeding, and this is what we call computational plant breeder. I've published a paper last year on Journal of Plant Physiology, and I've just, you know, sometimes criticized actual my position, because my position is dry bean breeder and computational biologist, and I just mentioned exactly my position and my title in the paper. I said, hey, everyone can call me computational plant breeder instead of plant breeding and computational biologist, because we are using computational biology to program plant breeding. So how about calling a person computational breeder? Like, you know, myself, I can consider myself as a computational dry bean breeder. So anyway, this is the programmable breeding pipeline look like.
I am, to the listeners, I am going to do my best to resist nerding out today and asking technical questions that indulge my curiosity, but I'm going to have to ask one right now. One of the big things going on in the AI space are simulations and mass simulations. To what extent can you simulate some of the cycles that you describe? Because on the one hand, there's the practical, right? The field tests and seeing how the plant performs in nature and monitoring that data and repeating it. But I have to assume you're also running simulations to come up with scenarios and hypotheses and other stuff to test. For the non-nerds who are listening, describe the value that that plays and the potential that that has for agriculture as a whole in terms of how we've historically been limited to nature's cycle. But now we have access to things like digital twins that allow us to kind of simulate what a field is going to do.
Yeah, I was going to touch about digital twins as well. I'm so glad that you touch it. So basically the point is, you know, let me start in this way. What we used to do is just we grow thousands of individual plants in the field, and which with the hope of selecting one of them, right? And the one superior of them. Like, let's say I'm growing around 200,000 individual plants at one stage of my breeding program. And then I'm trying to shrinking down these numbers that at the end, like after 8-10 years, I'm reaching to one best. So you can see that how many plants here are sacrificing. And why such this kind of things happen is because we wanted to test it on different environments. We don't have a good simulation analysis in the indoor to just prove that what will happen in the field, right? And we can, instead of growing 200,000 individual plants with like spending so much time, money, investing so many things there, how about running a good simulation and just shrinking down to 1,000, right? So this is something that people, when they are designing the jet engine, you know, they are doing that. They don't want it to just, you know, let people just flying with the jet engine and see what will happen, right? They are caring about people's life. And so we have to care about plants, right? In this case. So the terms of the digital twin is something very new, very good. And I think that's the future of the breeding programs. They need to run digital twins, and we have it. We have it at University of Guelph. What I'm doing is I'm trying to simulate that what if this plant with these gene characters, with this genotype, like, you know, with this genetic background, what if this plant exposed to this type of stresses? How the plants look like? How the plants perform, right? How plants perform if you are putting this in totally new environments? And with this soil type, these are kind of simulation. So recently, one of the projects that is going on right now is in my program is we try to predict what will happen in the future in different environments that they are mostly grown dry beans. And how we are doing that, we actually have like the good history of growing dry beans in those regions like Ellora, in Ontario, we are growing, like, you know, in Woodstock, in different areas, right? We are growing dry beans, different market classes of dry beans there for many years. So we have the data, we have the environmental information, like the total precipitation, maximum temperature, minimum temperature, all those kind of things, we have it. And now what we have is we have the future scenarios. So there are some anthropogenic climate change scenarios that is available for scientists to use. And this is based on different, like, you know, future, like different scenarios that what if CO2 emission went high and goes up, like, you know, higher than current, right? What will happen in terms of the temperature? If the situation is normal, what will happen? If the situation is mild, what will happen? And we have all this environmental information year by year for the next 50 years in different locations. Of course, it's not accurate, it's not 100% correct, but it can give us a good hint. So if we developed a program, everything based on the history, and then we feed the future data there, we can predict how much this plant perform in new environment with the new temperature. So once we find it, instead of just blindly making cross, not blindly, just making cross and selecting potential pattern lines based on the history, we are selecting patterns based on history and the future. You know what? So that's the main concept of digital twin. And we can run it, we can test it, and we are doing it at the same time. Yeah.
Right on. And the capacity, like just the research questions alone that that kind of thing enables kind of blows my mind. But let me come back to something we touched upon earlier. Are you still blazing this trail alone, or are there other people catching up? Like, give me a sense of the computational breeding landscape. Are there other people who are cluing in to what Molson's been up to and saying, hey, that looks like fun stuff? And what is the collaborative space like? Like, who are you able to work with, not just at the University of Guelph, but yeah, I assume that the more people who are kind of ready to play, ready to dance, ready to engage in these types of methods, the greater the value for all of you.
Oh. Yeah, I have a very good colleagues, you know, all around the world. Those are perfect. You know, I'm proud of the community that I'm working in terms of the academia. I don't want to talk only about University of Guelph, but you know that, you know, University of Guelph fostering collaboration, like, you know, and they are fostering collaboration environment. So we are having a highest collaborations between different departments and others. But aside from University of Guelph, I'm right now collaborating with different researchers in Canada, like University of Laval, Ottawa, like, you know, I'm working with Saskatchewan, but, and also US, like, you know, entire North America, I'm collaborating mostly with, so there are tons of, you know, good breeders that they are working in this area. And you know what? All of them, like, you know, I had a chance to talk to a couple of them, and I know that, you know, we are somehow complement our jobs. Like, they are working, I'm working on this, developing new algorithms and everything, and they are using all the algorithms, like most of the algorithms that we are developing here, to test them on different locations, and I'm doing the same thing. So we are just trying to validate our algorithms. We are trying to validate our pipeline, right? And we are not only looking for the very small scale of the regions that we are working, we wanted to expand it, right? And right now I'm collaborating with some universities in France, some universities in UK, right? Those peoples are also interested. And you know what? I remember when I developed some of the algorithms and I published these algorithms, I received very good and positive feedbacks that, hey, how you did that? We wanted to test it in our genotypes. We are working on grape. Do you think that the algorithms that you develop in dry beans would work in grape? And I said that, oh yeah, why not? Let's check it, right? And we check it. We fine-tuning all those algorithms and now it's work, right? It works. So basically, yeah, there are very collaborative environment all around the world. We are, I can't say there are tons of us, you know, to working in this area, but there are a couple of us, some of us, you know, are working in this area in the computation as a computational plant breeder. Yeah.
And at the risk of asking another nerd question, which, you know, we will do our best to try to answer as accessibly as possible, talk to me. You know, one of the research interests you have on your profile talks about computational tools and AI platforms, in that the subtext of everything we're describing is there, you know, you need technology to gather data, you need technology to analyze data. Of course, the digital twin stuff is a whole other scale. Without getting into the details of it, how accessible are these tools? How available are these tools? And how rapidly are they being developed? To your point of, you know, there's some computational breeders, but how do we scale that number up? In the sense that part of it is just access to the tools and access to the literacy to use those tools.
No, that's a very great question. So basically, I remember, like, you know, 8 to 9 years ago, I was just focusing on developing different algorithms to use whatever data that we are producing to make a prediction and can help us to screen large number of genotypes, not large number of actual plants, you know, in the field. And we are able to detect diseases at the earliest stages, those kind of things. And that was all limited to the prediction ability. So we call them predictive AI algorithms, and there are tons of them, right? So gradually, we shifted from only working on the predictive to also working on the generative AI. And what does this generative AI means? It means that how about we are asking question and we are getting an answer, response by AI. So AI can generate response for us. So how AI can generate response? It can be based on tons of things that we are feeding AI, right? And I was just thinking, okay, what kind of information do we have that I can develop this kind of generative AI? And I had a little search. I just wanted to share it with you. So on the year of 1970, there were around 12 to 15 publications on dry beans. Right now in 2026, actually 2025, like last year, it was around 2,900 papers that were published in dry beans. So you will see that, you know, how much scale were large, you know, right now is large. The same for the conferences. I've searched, or even the same for the word, the actual dry bean word over the internet. On 1970, it was 120 times the word of dry bean was repeated over the internet. Right now, it's more than 6 million times. So why this word is getting repeated? And I've searched and I found out, oh yeah, there are tons of valuable information there over the internet. Even without need, there is a need for us to produce more data. We have tons of data. So the challenge from the last 8 years, I think it's changed from do we have the data to how we can find reliable and relevant answers quickly, right? Those type of things. So on that time, I was just searching to see if there are any like pipeline established that I can use it, or if there is any integration I can make it. I couldn't find it. So I started to do it and build everything from scratch. So I started to develop something like an app that called right now is called BeanGPT, right? So this app, BeanGPT, we collected more than 300,000 literatures all over the world. And we indexed all of them. We collected all the genetics, all the phenotypes, all the agronomy, all the notes, everything that was published in dry beans, and put it in the BeanGPT. And you know what? When you are right now asking question, BeanGPT search and finding relevant answer based on only these information, not based on the general, like the ChatGPT or the Claude and others, right? So how we find this information, it was really hard because, you know, so many of this information were not publicly available. We had to ask, you know, and so many things. But right now I'm seeing that, you know, these type of retrieving information and gathering information is getting facilitated because people right now understand the importance of sharing these type of information and building such kind of apps, right? So that was one of the app. The predictive AI was another app, right? And now the challenge is how to make it hybrid. How to have the prediction and actually validate whatever we are predicting by tons of information out there through, let's say, Bing GPT. And this is the hybrid AI, right? So I don't want to go through the details and talk about all these type of things. You know, I don't want it to be nerd here, but, you know, I'm getting fascinated every time that I'm talking about AI, and I can talk for hours. But you know what? Right now, the future of AI in agriculture is how to make a hybrid AI, like the quantum hybrid AI. And this is something that we are trying to go toward it and move toward it, right?
And I am going to have you back on the show because I, too, can talk about AI for hours. And I think we're going to at some point organize a panel in which we together talk about AI and agriculture. But I want to ask an important follow-up question around Bing GPT from a kind of user perspective. Because one of, I think, the appeals of like ChatGPT and Claude is it makes complicated stuff accessible, right? It makes it easier for people to talk about law or other complicated areas and learn the terminology. Does Bing GPT enable, say, Bing Genetics to be more accessible to a student agronomist or a bean farmer who maybe has mixed scientific knowledge? Does it enable that kind of accessibility and the kind of learning curve to get people into computational breeding?
Absolutely. Absolutely, Jess. You know, the point is the main point of developing Bing GPT is to make it accessible for a variety of people with different background, with different knowledge. And it's not only designed for myself or, like, you know, and any other person specifically. The point is, when you are asking any question in Bing GPT, Bing GPT try to answer fully in a very simple way. Let's say you are interested in a specific, like, you know, agronomic practice in dry beans, and you're asking this question, okay, what would be the best herbicide in this case, and when I can apply this herbicide in my field? So Bing GPT is trying to find relevant research and then try to make it, like, you know, simple, but just make it more understandable and just provide the answer to you. I can tell you that, you know, Bing GPT is not one app, is not one algorithm. It's a kind of committee that consists of 8 different algorithms. We call it RAG models, right? We call it retrieval augmented, augmented generative, like, you know, models. So these kind of models, each of them are trained for a specific data. One of them trained only for literatures. One of them is going to only search for the data. One of them is going to only search for the agronomy. One of them only going to search for the environmental data. So many information. When you are asking question, all these people are discussing together and they just threw out some of the words, some of the information. And who collect all this information is the OpenAI, is the GPT. GPT collect all this information, make it simple, make it ready, and give it to the user. So no matter if you are expert in the bean area, no matter to what kind of knowledge, to what knowledge you have about bean, no matter that what you are going to search, like in terms of, and you wanted to get, Bing GPT try to provide you as simple as possible, as understandable as possible.
Now, I keep wanting to go to the environmental scan questions, but do you know of other similar plant-based GPTs or similar kind of agri-centric GPTs?
I've seen a couple, actually. You know, they just recently released a couple of GPTs, but you know what? I haven't had a chance to dig into all of them in detail, but what I found that, you know, they are specializing in a couple of databases. Like, one of them are only looking for the literatures, right? Another GPT is only looking for some, like, you know, reports and data. And I couldn't find that, you know, there is one, like, you know, large language model that it's not one, actually, it's a couple, yeah, that each, yeah, of them are specializing on different algorithms, different database. And then when you are asking question, your question is going to circulate among all these apps, all these, like, you know, algorithms. So it's not one, and I couldn't find the same and the similar things in others.
I mean, this is where I will nerd out for a moment and say, this is partly the revolution of OpenClaw and the harnesses, right? Of creating a software layer that can access multiple models and combine that with a growing memory. We're digressing. We'll talk about that in the advanced episode. But on a related point, as someone who I assume also teaches and also engages with students, tell me, what's that like? Like, what are the students who are coming to you? What are their research interests? And as a teacher, what are you trying to get those students to focus on? Because so far, I think my mind has been blown just thinking about computational breeding and the kind of research you're doing and the tools you're doing. But part of what we do here on the Future Herd is think about the future. And of course, that's where the students come in. So give us a glimpse. Give us a sense of where their interests are and what you're trying to get them to look at.
Yeah. So actually, you know, every winter semester, I actually developed a course at the Plant Agriculture Department at University of Guelph. And the course is mostly about, you know, intro to computational biology and agricultural science. So I'm trying to teach different omics, we call it like different words, like, you know, phenomics, genomics, transcriptomics, proteomics, all these kind of word, like big words, and how we can integrate all of them through different AI and through different algorithms, and how we can find the best, like, you know, the actual background behind any traits of interest that we are interested to work with. So this is one of the courses that I developed for the graduate students and also for the undergrad, specifically for the second year undergrad students. I was just thinking, okay, how about letting students to make their hand more dirty into the data? So I developed Biodata for People, Plant, Planet, and I'm going to teach it for the first time in this coming fall. And I'm not sure that, you know, what will happen, but I'm really looking forward to that. And I'm thinking that, you know, it would be a good source for a student to make them ready for the future courses that they are going to take, right? So far, and like, you know, last year I was able to teach applied bioinformatics and how we are using bioinformatics in agriculture. So all of them, I found that, you know, students are very much interested to use trends. Like, they are interested to work with AI. And every time they're telling me, okay, Mohsen, we love to work AI. How we are developing this AI? How we are working with that AI? And the first question that I'm asking them is, why you wanted to work with AI? Is it, do you think that, you know, AI is really right tools for you? What type of data you have? Do you think your data is big enough? Or your data is large? Or your data is streaming data? Or the complex data? Each of them has different meaning. So don't get interested, don't get excited, and just brag that, hey, I'm working with AI. Of course, working with AI is good. But have you had this kind of, like, you know, good understanding why you wanted to do that? So this is something that I'm going to teach. Analytical thinking. Just think before selecting the right or the, like, you know, whatever algorithms, whatever path you wanted to choose in your future. Just think before that. Don't just follow because it's trend. Don't get excited of everything that comes new. If you are seeing, okay, this is the huge potential, even, you know, the reason, just that's interesting. The reason that I started to work with machine learning and those AI, like, you know, many years ago, was not because on that time it was not trendy. But I was just searching among all the literatures and I found that, okay, there may be a good use of these kind of algorithms in agriculture. I can test them. So I started to test them. And even, you know, I told you that on that time, no one buy it, right? You know, they told me that, okay, yeah, you are living on your dream and you are not an actual breeder. But I never gave up because, you know, I just wanted to work on that area. And I did. And now you are seeing that, okay, here is the real things, right? And we are working on everyday life. So if I wanted to just only use whatever is getting trend, I'm not going to be successful. And this is something that I wanted to teach my students. And I, like, you know, they are at the end of the semester, they are all getting appreciated. And said that, hey, right now we have a good understanding of whatever data we have. Or maybe we can use the simple statistical analysis and we can get the whatever we wanted, right? It's not just only using the fancy AI, we can use a simple but having a good discussion and understand why and what is the data and how we can use this data in a better way.
Okay, let me see if I can use a metaphor to set up my next question, because one of the recurring themes of our conversation today, which I think you just evoked again, is the idea that there's this learning curve. And to be a good researcher, you want to push yourself up that learning curve. You want to challenge yourself and, to your point, not be content to be in the trends, but to really try to go further and anticipate either your own curiosity or where the world is headed. That's clearly what you're encouraging your students to do. Where does industry fall in that learning curve, right? In your interactions, not just with big industry, but even farmers, even agronomists, people who are curious about this stuff, where are they on that learning curve? And how do you do what you do with the students, which is encourage them to be courageous, encourage them to really try to imagine where we need to be to make the most of this technology and these tools?
Oh, yeah. So you know what? This is actually one of the things that I'm working every day. And at the same time, I'm trying to improve my day every day by any interaction that I have with farmers, growers, industry partners, and also government bodies. So each of them, you need to make sure that you know their own language and you know how to talk with them, right? It's not like something that I can talk about the RAG models and some of the statistical analysis behind everything to the farmers. They all just saying, okay, what would be the most benefit of it? And what I found is farmers really appreciate something that I can just show them, hey, here is something that would work, right? Test them and see if it works. You guys can also dig into it and learn more about it, and we can work together. And you know what? I'm proud to say that I have a very good supporters in terms of the farmers. I have Ontario Bean Growers. They are supporting me in different aspects of my program. And most of the times they invited me to give a talk to their AGM, to their research day. But they are not asking me to talk about the actual bean seeds or anything. Last time they asked me to talk about Bean GPT, because they are also interested to see what is this Bean GPT look like, how they can use this AI in their actual day-to-day work, right? And it was last Friday that I was talking to a couple of them, and I told them that, yeah, here is the AI, here is what we are doing. And they told me that they are advocating for AI in different committee on my behalf. You know what? This is the interaction, this is the relation that I really appreciate. I really admire that. And I've seen such this kind of openness in different places, but it depends on how you approach it then. Another example that I can give you about like some of the industry partners that I'm working with them. So they are actually appreciated AI. They are actually appreciated these kind of trends, things and everything. But to what extent? What is the benefits? If you can show the real benefit to them, that's perfect. If you couldn't prove it, okay, so what's the point, right? And this is the gap that I think it's in the research areas, that we are doing so many advanced technologies and advancing things, right? But when we wanted to translate to the actual, to the applied settings, we are sometimes lagging behind. So this is something that I'm actually learning every day, and it's a learning curve for me. And I'm also trying to provide this kind of experience that I had, to my students and everyone who like to work as an industry partners, industry work in the industry or academia in the future. And also the last part is, in this case, is whatever we are training, whoever we are training right now, they are going to build the future. So if we are able to tell them, okay, here is the research and here is the way that we are interacting, they can also realize, okay, this is the way that the academia interact with the farmers, with the growers, with the industry partners. Once they are become a farmer, become a grower, become industry person in the future, they are realizing this kind of interaction. This kind of relation has already been built, right? So It can facilitate. So whatever that we are doing is not only benefiting us for today, it's also for the future and the future generation. And this is something that I follow.
So let me throw a relevant follow-up at you. And I say this only because I've encountered this myself, and I'm kind of curious what your advice would be or what your approach would be. But I think a lot of the farmers that you're describing are kind of self-selected curious. And on the one end, you're right, they want to see the tangible, they want to see how it works. But I think who we should acknowledge, because they're the people who don't come up, are those who are afraid. Because there are people in our society, for various different reasons, who are kind of scared of AI. I encounter that all the time. I try to foster their curiosity. I try to help them see past all the nonsense to look at it as a tool that can help them. But how do you approach that? You know, how do you deal with people who, whether they're in the agricultural sector or in your family or people you just encounter on the street and they know Molson is a guy who's into AI, how do you address that kind of fear? Because I think for some people, it's like the obstacle to them learning all the stuff that we're talking about that I think we both think is really exciting.
Oh, that's actually, this is one of the most important things that we are facing these days, to just make sure, like, you know, it's at the same time we are certain about some sort of things, and at the same time we are uncertain about some sort of things that are happening. So I can tell you an example. So many people ask me the same question. Will AI replace our job? What do we need to do? Like, you know, these AI, I can't trust AI. How you are like building everything on the AI, not everything, most of the things that you are working has been built, you know, in AI. How you do that? Are you not afraid when you are developing a co-breeder, AI co-breeder, when you are not afraid that these co-breeder will in the future is getting to an actual breeder and they can replace your job? So I received these tons of questions. And you know what? Up to a couple of months ago, I had not a clear answer for them. I was just trying to say, okay, yeah, here's the AI would be good. I don't know what will happen in the future, but if you have the good idea, if you have the good, like, you know, working in this area, there are always, you know, job for you. There are always, you are not just AI is going to help you. So I was just answering these kind of things until at one night over the weekend, I was just got bored of the watching TV. So I decided to start back to the working. And I exactly remember that it was like 11 a.m. It was somehow at the midnight. I was asking Claude to develop an app that is currently exist, but adding these new informations and these new techniques there. So I asked Claude that, hey, Claude, can you develop ODM? There is an app, like call it Web ODM. I don't want to go through the details, but this is for the stitching all the drone images together to get the actual orthomosaic picture. So I asked this, Claude, that can you develop Web ODM for me? And Claude, at the first glance, responded, yes, here is the one. So I check it and I found that no, it's not. I replied back, no, it's not. Can you do this? Again, the same thing. Ask, no, that's not. Can you redo this? Redo. And it was around 5 a.m. After tons of back and forth, I got so frustrated and I asked Claude, hey, Claude, I told you to create this app for me. Why you are doing this? And you know what Claude responded back to me? That was interesting. Claude responded back, I understand your frustration, but just to let you know that WebODM was built based on human, and it was built for, like, you know, it's around 500,000 lines of code there. I'm AI and I'm only able to develop 4,000, 5,000 lines of code. I'm not able to do that. So, you know what? At 5 a.m., I was just thinking, okay, I got the answer. Will AI replace our job? It depends how many lines of code we are worth it. If you are worth 5,000 lines of code, of course, you can be replaced. If it's 500,000 lines of code with a novel idea with tons of work behind it, no, it's not going to happen. And you are the one who are going to train AI. You are the one who are going to just, you know, build AI. So that's the answer I found it. And it was like, you know, it cost me 6 hours nonstop, like back and forth with Claude. But finally, I found the right answer to, like, you know, respond. Like anyone who are asking me right now, I have something to say. Yeah, it totally depends on you. I can't tell you that will AI replace your job or not. Check, see how many lines of code you are worth it.
Well, and the brilliance of that answer is that with each research paper that you read, the lines of code in your software increases. Every research paper you write exponentially increases the lines of code in your software stack. And this is where I will say to any farmers or drone operators listening, if you don't know what WebODM is, give it a Google. Because if you do have a drone, you can do a lot of fun stuff with WebODM. We're digressing. We're just about out of time, Mohsin. And the one of the last questions I ask our guests, this is usually the second last I ask, is there anything that we haven't talked about today that we should talk about? And this could be research that you're currently excited about, or concerns or thoughts that you want other leaders in the sector to be thinking about when it comes to these tools and it comes to the potential of these tools.
Oh, yeah. So, you know what? I appreciate it. Just, you know, we've covered so many different things, and I really enjoy talking to you. Something that I just wanted to put emphasis on it is whatever we are developing, whatever we are advancing, we should appreciate what has been built for many years in the past. We cannot replace our tradition. We cannot replace whatever have been built, right? And I'm seeing that, you know, most of the times that I'm submitting any proposals or developing new ideas and I'm just talking about it, people often ask me that, hey, Mohsin, are you traditional breeder or you are the new breeder or whatever? You wanted to just use, you are not using any traditional things. You are using like new and innovative tools. And I wanted to say it's a mixture of both. I have to respect traditional breeding. Traditional breeding is something that I cannot replace it. No one can replace it with any new technologies. We can complement whatever has been built for many years. And it's the science. It's not practical. It's not based on probability. It's not so many. It's pure science. And you know what? We have in the definition of the plant breeding as the art and science. And it's totally true. I've just right now realized it with my own, like, you know, feeling. Like, you know, the point is, we have to make a best decision by our eye, by our feeling, and we have to be an artist to develop and design a good plant. At the same time, we need to follow science to see what's going on the biological background, what is the biological background behind any traits, how this plant look like, how this plant perform, get the DNA, other things. So this should be acknowledged that plant breeding is actual science. It's not the practical things that we are doing, right? And for any plant breeder, our job is not finding the best. Our job is to find the real assets in everything that we are working. It's something that I'm trying to move toward it. I'm trying to just realize even a little and tiny data that we are collecting, a small plant that we are living in the field, what we can best do from, like, you know, how we can use of them, right? So this is something that I wanted to emphasize more about it and just, you know, let you know that you know, this kind of breeding, like I can talk on behalf of all plant breeders, and I know that, you know, they all would be appreciated that I'm telling this, that for every like dollar that is spending in this area, it's around $35 to $40 we are receiving, like, you know, any government receiving back, right? So it's, you are spending $1 and you are receiving $35 to $40 back. So these supports need to be continued. If you are stopping supporting anything, like, you know, plant breeders, it's not showing tomorrow, it's showing in the next 10 years. And that time, there is no way that you can get it back and turning back, right? I just wanted
Wow.
to give it this credit, like $1 to $35, to Doug Miller, the former executive director of Canadian Soybeans, CSGA, Canadian Society of CSGA. It's anyway,
Canadian
so
Soybean
sorry, I'm
Growers
just so bad in
Association?
memorizing. No, it's A is I can just search it, CSGA. It's Canadian Seed Grower Association.
Right on.
Yeah.
Right on.
It is Canadian Seed Grower Association.
And in fact, you kind of previewed what perhaps we should talk about the next time I have you on, because we've alluded today the entire time to food security. But due to my fault, we've spent a lot of time focusing on the technology and the role technology plays. But we can talk about the role that technology plays around food security. To your point about the payback that comes from spending money on researching plant breeding and researching, in particular, beans. And the last question, which again, you almost just kind of answered right there. The last question I throw to guests is, who do you look up to? Who are the leaders that we should be listening to? It's kind of the shout out section of the show, and it's meant to be spontaneous. It's meant to catch you off guard in the sense, what's the first name that comes to your head?
In the plant breeding area or in the computational biology or like, you know,
Anywhere. This
anything
is like
can
the
be.
first question. What is the future? This is the last
Oh,
question.
that.
Who do you look to for inspiration?
Oh, I'm just looking like, you know, the first name that is coming to my mind is Dr. Rex Bernardo is coming to my mind. And I have tons of people who I really admire them, and I'm just following their work and everything. Dr. Seth Murray, I'm just, you know, following their work. And yeah, there are tons. I can't really, you know, tell you about it. And it's not only
Oh.
breeders, they are also some of the farmers, growers, like, you know, industry partners. They are all people who are following, yeah.
And that's why I throw it as the last question, because it's not like it's, you know, the Oscars or the Academy Awards where you can thank all the people who helped
I
make the
know,
movie. This is about one or two names, and you did it spectacularly, Mohsen. And speaking of which, this episode, like many of our episodes, has completely blown my mind, partly because of the enthusiasm you bring to your research, but also because I really feel you make this stuff accessible. Like you really help, to your point, farmers have kind of forced you to talk about this stuff in a way that gets to the point, that speaks to kind of what's at stake and what the opportunity is. So thank you very much. I mean, I really feel that this is the start of some conversations between us to really help people see what you see, which is the potential for this technology to really not just revolutionize agriculture, but address food security at a global scale. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Just the point is, you know, I'm moving toward it to make everything accessible, to make it everything like, you know, facilitated for learning. And I'm at the same time learning. And you know what? Something that I wanted to say at the end is none of the things that I'm right now doing would have been possible without the great support of my mentors, Dr. Ishwan Rachans, you know, and also like, you know, some of the supporters that I have, like the Ontario Bean Growers, right? So, and OMAFA that I just, you know, support, I received the support, and CERC. Those, like, you know, supporters are just very, like, you know, helpful to build up my research program, and they are trusting me on just doing all these kind of things. So I would like to also thank them at the end as well. But
Right
yeah,
on.
thanks for having me, and I'm really looking forward to have another conversation with you about more exciting stuff, right?
Right on. I hope you enjoyed that half as much as Mohsen and I did. It's no exaggeration to say that sometimes talking about AI leads to a kind of time blindness where you don't even realize how long, how much time has passed. While I do make an effort to keep our episodes on time, clearly Mohsen and I are going to have to continue this conversation, if only to explore the kind of Venn diagram where traditional agriculture and some of these new practices overlap. Because what I found so affirming about Mohsen's worldview is it's not an either or. It's not about embracing the future at the expense of the past. Rather, it's about using the future to reinforce our values from the past, to use data and intuition together and in concert. And that's why accessibility matters. That's why when it comes to talking about technology on the farm, it's not about companies, it's not about experts. It's about farmers playing with these tools, seeing how they can bend the tools to their practices rather than expecting their practices to bend to the tools. Now, before we close, I do want to point out that we've got an exciting new pilot project on called commons.thefutureher.ca. We're currently soliciting your views about food security. And we did kind of touch upon that today in terms of AI and food security. But we are going to be expanding the topics that we are focusing on when it comes to employing the commons, one of which is going to be the 2050 process itself. What do you see in the future? But another is going to be about AI and agriculture, which includes ethics, which includes governance, which quite frankly includes any views you may have on AI. So if you're still listening, that means you enjoyed this episode enough to at least share it with your friends, but also to go check out our website and see what we've going on, some of the features we've got, so that moving forward, you can see yourself as part of the herd, even when I press the intro button, and instead I want the outro button, so I can evoke that kind of 1970s television vibe that I'm currently using to set the tone, the motif, the culture of the future herd. If you have any questions about the podcast, about the process, about the agentic software we're billing to facilitate podcast production, drop us a line. Hello@thefutureherd.ca or complain or kvetch about us on social media. What did they used to say? Good news, bad news. It's all news. Good attention, bad attention. It's all attention. And if there's anything we want, it's yours. I'm Jesse Hirsch. See ya.